On our show coming up, first we're going to hear from Jeffrey Sachs, talking mostly about Ukraine. And then we'll hear from Shahid Bolson, a very strong critic of U.S. policy. We'll hear him condemn the racist blaming by U.S. bigots of all of their problems on the Jews. It's going to be a truncated interview due to our shortage of time here. But anyway, today we'll hear Jeffrey Sachs and Shahid Bolson. So here is Jeffrey Sachs.
Well, absolutely. You know, Georgia, together with its two other neighbors, Armenia and Azerbaijan, are part of this great game that has been going on for centuries, actually, between Britain and Russia, and between the United States and Russia in the last 30 years. This is contested territory. These are borderlands. These are places where the United States has actively tried to intervene, specifically in Georgia, to expand NATO. So this is part of the plan that includes Ukraine to surround Russia and the Black Sea region with NATO. This is Brzezinski's plan from the 1990s, riffing off of Lord Palmerston's plan in the 1850s. And Georgia became part of that game. And it has been a deadly game because it involved one hot war between Russia and Georgia in 2008 and a continuing very tense situation in recent years. So you have this region, the South Caucasus. These are the small countries, very historic. If you look at Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, with civilizations that go back thousands of years, Georgia, arguably 10,000 years of recognizable civilization, that have been contested zones, actually, between east and west, north and south for thousands of years. They are countries, a region at the crossroads, of east and west, at the crossroads of Christianity and Islam. Within the region itself, contested territory between three great imperial powers of the last 600 years of history, the Ottoman Turks, the Iranians, and the Russians. And so those three empires, even without the United States and Britain, have been fighting among themselves and contesting this territory. But after 1991, and even during the Cold War, I would say, it was viewed as the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union or the soft underbelly of Russia, and therefore a place where the CIA could meddle, a place where the American deep state could meddle, a place where American so-called non-governmental organizations, which are very much governmental organizations, part of the U.S. deep state, could try to intervene and swing politics. And Georgia got caught completely in that, because Georgia was one of the locations where the United States helped to arrange the overthrow of a government, the Rose Revolution of 2004, which overthrew Shevardnadze and installed a Western favorite, Saakashvili, backed by George Soros personally and backed by U.S. money personally. And he was the stooge, I would say, to promote the entry of NATO and the EU into the region. Now, one thing about the EU being there also, this region, if you ask a geographer, is not in Europe. These are countries south of the Great Caucasus Mountains. The crest line of the Caucasus Mountains is the divide between Europe to the north, that's Russia, and Asia to the south. So these aren't even geographically part of Europe. But the European Union, in this neocon U.S.-promoted age, wanted to take territory as NATO expands. So they went side by side, as in Ukraine as well. And Saakashvili became the instrument for that. And in 2008, at this infamous NATO Bucharest summit, which was the, I would say, in a way, a turning point when Europe fell completely into line with U.S. neoconservatism, that Georgia and Ukraine together at that NATO summit were invited into NATO. That was, I think, the turning point from cold to hot war that ensued. And in the case of Georgia, Saakashvili, I can tell you, I'll tell you one anecdote, but he took this invitation to NATO as also the invitation to attack a breakaway territory and try to reclaim it for Georgia, thinking that NATO has his back and the United States has his back. And he lost a war with Russia in 2008. He ended up in many weird adventures of politics throughout the region, including in Ukraine, and very bizarre guy. But in any event, this thrust Georgia into the front line of the Russia-U.S. confrontation. And it's been there until basically now. The governing party, the Georgia Dream, which you you will know more about and be more up to date than I am, having just visited, is trying to extricate Georgia from all of this great game, because this great game is not conducive to peace, to security, or to economic development. It is a disaster. It is being used as a pawn of somebody else, and in this case, a pawn of the United States. And I just wanted to tell you an anecdote. We discuss all the time how Ukraine became a pawn of the United States and has been devastated and bloodied and degraded and divided because of this neocon Palmerston idea of grabbing Ukraine for NATO and for the West and so forth. In 2008, as this was brewing, this NATO enlargement, Saakashvili actually came to New York, came to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City in April or May 2008. And I was curious, so I thought I'd go over and listen to him. So I walked across Central Park and went to hear him speak. And it was incredible. We are part of Europe. We've always been part of Europe. We will be part of NATO. We will be part of the European Union. We are the most European country. And of course, all these fools, I have to say, in New York, in the audience, yeah, you're wonderful. We've got your back and so forth. And I remember I walked out of the building and I called my wife because I was shaking. I said, this guy is so reckless. This guy is nuts. This guy is going to get his country destroyed. And it was just, I don't know, maybe 2 or 4 weeks later that the war broke out and that indeed Saakashvili was smashed as a result. But I had that very personal presence of this insane arrogance that the United States gives these countries. They think the U.S. has their back. Now we can do anything. We'll defeat Russia. We can put it in their face. And this is the mindset that has led us to disaster all over the region. But that's a very long-winded answer to your question. But the core of the issue is for Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, they've been caught in a U.S. game from the 1990s, partly to weaken Russia, partly to grab oil resources in the Caspian region, partly to build a Caspian Black Sea pipeline that would that would go around Russia. In other words, great game stuff with some of the big names of the neocon world involved from the start. Brzezinski always around, Scowcroft, Kissinger, amazing, playing games in this region, thinking that this was part of the post-1991 process of further weakening or deconstructing or decolonizing Russia. And these three little, wonderful, amazing, historic countries have gotten caught in the middle of it, and they're trying to extricate themselves from it. Mm. And Europe continues to meddle nonstop. The U.S. has tried, but I don't think, I hope that Trump has no interest in this. So maybe they actually have a chance on their own for some economic development. Bottom line and final point, I should say, my recommendation to them is look at your map, look at your geography, look at your neighborhood. That's how you do economics to start. You have neighbors. You trade with your neighbors. You have investments with your neighbors. You have infrastructure with your neighbors. The three neighbors are three big powers, Russia, Turkey, and Iran, three historic civilizations. They actually are getting along reasonably well right now, thank you. And that gives a chance for the three South Caucasus countries, which really have a shared destiny as well, to say, look, we can be prosperous within this region by having decent relations with all three sides. The United States is not our issue. The EU is not our issue. But Russia, Iran, Turkey, the Middle East, a north-south trade and infrastructure corridor, an east-west trade corridor, that's our future. And we can be prosperous service centers, touristic centers, communication, and digital hubs. We can have a very nice future if it's peaceful in our region.
I'll just very, very quickly say that the overwhelming impression that I got whilst I was there in Georgia is that they do not want to be contested territory anymore. They've had enough of that. They want to be themselves, their old countries, old civilizations.
Exactly.
They want to forge that. They want to forge their own destiny. And that, it seemed to me, is the overwhelming feeling within Georgian society. Anyway, since we've only got you for a short time because we talk about South Caucasus a lot, but let's move on to something else, something very close to home for me. There's been an absolutely terrifying article by David Ignatius in, I think it was the New York Times, or no, it was the Washington Post, that's where he writes, about yes. dirty wars and all kinds of things. The Russians, and I am absolutely sure they're completely correct about this, are saying that it's the British who are egging the Ukrainians to conduct these dirty wars. Dirty wars, to be quite clear, is about assassination, sabotage, acts of terrorism, all of those kind of things across Russia and Russian territory. What are we, and by we I mean Britain, but also the United States, thinking that we are doing by getting involved in something like this? Have we gone out of our minds? That is what I wanted to ask, because
yes.
it seems no, to me we should be seeking peace, and instead some people seem to be keen on getting us involved in thinking in things like this. Over to you.
Yeah, no, it's a terrifying article, by the way. I agree with you. And we should put it in proper context. David Ignatius is the mouthpiece, almost the formal mouthpiece, I would say, but not quite, of the CIA. So he is the writer on the Washington Post who conveys the CIA news. He writes from the CIA perspective. He describes what the CIA is thinking. He does not do that critically, scratching his head saying what's going on. He does it straightforwardly as if this is matter of fact news. So he's interesting to read, not in his analysis, but as a faithful reporter of the Central Intelligence Agency and the intelligence community generally. So when you read him, you're hearing something from intelligence officials pretty directly. The article was shocking how stupid it is, if you take it on its face, by the way, aside from being frightening. First, it says that there were no negotiations because Russia put down an ultimatum for complete capitulation of Ukraine. And then it says, what is capitulation? Capitulation is neutrality. I don't even remember a couple of the other things, but it had nothing to do with capitulation. Capitulation is surrender. But the way that it was written straightforwardly was capitulation means you become neutral. He didn't use the word NATO. That was another interesting point. But it had nothing. It showed completely propagandistically Russia's negotiating stance is not the capitulation of Ukraine. Russia's negotiating stance is neutrality of Ukraine, security arrangements that are mutually secure for Russia and Ukraine, and territorial requirements on the Russian side that are contestable, by the way, in negotiations, at least to some extent. Some are not contestable, I'm sure. But that is not capitulation. But Ignatius used the idea that this is not negotiation. This is the ultimate capitulation. And that's already the CIA propaganda, to say there's nothing to talk about. There's nothing there. We think maybe, I think so, that Donald Trump knows better than that. I think that he understands that not joining NATO for Ukraine is not capitulation. It's sanity for Russia, for the United States, and for Ukraine. Neutrality is exactly what's needed. But then the next paragraph of that article, after disposing of Russia's demands for capitulation, said Ukraine will never give up its right to join the Euro-Atlantic community. Again, propaganda. NATO isn't mentioned in the article. NATO is different anyway from the EU. Russia has always taken a different view of joining NATO from joining the European Union. It's been the game of the neocons and the game of Washington and the game of the CIA and MI6 to conflate the two completely. The UK should know better. It's actually part of NATO, but it is not part of the EU. So the two, in principle, are different, but not in the minds of the hardcore West. But then, yes, the idea was we fight on, and it was saying that we are going to fight in every way, dirty wars, war on the battlefield, and so forth. And it was kind of a declaration of ongoing war. We will outlast the Trump administration. We will outlast Donald Trump. We will outlast these negotiations. We will fight on. So has Britain gone mad? I don't want to be impolite, but Britain's been mad for a long time. It hasn't gone mad. This is a British attitude towards Russia that dates back to 1840. Britain has been at war essentially with Russia since the 1840s. It went to a hot war on pretextual grounds, we would say, as if David Ignatius wrote such an article in 1853. The whole Crimean War was a concoction because Russia was complaining about the Ottoman Empire giving in to French demands. It made a minor provocative move of troops into Wallachia. The British stood up and said, "You can't do that." Got the French and Napoleon III alongside. The Russians said, okay, we leave. And then the British said, "You can't leave, we attack you." And so the British were so keen on war that they, of course, besieged Sevastopol with the idea of getting Russia out of the Black Sea. In other words, dismantling the Russian naval fleet, which actually occurred in the Treaty of Paris in 1856. This is Brzezinski's plan from 1997. Same idea, same geography. We're going to get Russia out of the Black Sea, making it a third-rate power. It won't have a navy that can enter the Eastern Mediterranean. Russia will be banished from involvement in the Middle East and so forth. So the war today is the same war. Now, MI6 and the CIA have been part of this from the start. And I would say, if we really look at when the start is, the start, you could date it to 1853. You could date it to the British Expeditionary Forces in Russia after World War I. And you can certainly date it to even the weeks after World War II, when the Soviet Union had been the lead country and the main ally that had smashed German war. Immediately, Churchill turned to his war cabinet and his military advisors and said, "Well, can we go to war with the Soviet Union now?" This was already in the summer of 1945, because the idea took hold almost immediately in the UK and US security circles. This is OSS days, even before the CIA was established. But in the high command, "Well, our next war will be with the Soviet Union." They were the allies that just lost 27 million people. But immediately, and I'm talking about June, July 1945, starting to think about the next war with the Soviet Union. What's amazing to me is how the end of the Soviet Union also didn't change this almost at all. We now go on to Russia. So it was without missing a beat that the end of the Soviet Union, the pretext of Bolshevism and communism as being the great threat, when that was gone, that also didn't change the idea of MI6 and the CIA. Now we need to dismantle Russia. And lest anyone think I'm kidding, read Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard of 1997, where he opines in his high-minded way that maybe Russia will divide into three countries, a European Russia, a Siberian Russia, an East Asian Russia, that could be in a loose confederation. This is the hubris of the U.S. and the U.K. for decades. And I'm afraid, I'm actually even more afraid of MI6, I have to say, not in its power, but in its recklessness. I mean, you look at Starmer. Sorry, I will say it. The guy's an idiot, but he is a mouthpiece of this deep state. And it's dangerous. And I found the attacks, you've been discussing them brilliantly for every day since they happened, but the attacks on the strategic bombers, which is clearly an MI6 operation, and probably the CIA was pretty heavily involved in it also. And certainly if they didn't know about it, the whole place needs cleaning out, because if you can't figure that out in 18 months, it is pathetic beyond belief. But the recklessness of going after the strategic triad of Russia, whether successful, not successful, the whole idea of it is just an invitation to nuclear war like nothing else. And there is the MI6 in its provocations. And our Western press stood up and cheered how clever this is, and Ignatius cheered how clever this is, as we take a step towards doom at the hands of these fools, the fools on our side I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Can I just say that one of the strange things about the British obsession is that it never in the end works. We just try all of these things and it fails. I mean, I'm not going to discuss the Crimean War, just to say that it didn't turn out at all well for Britain.
Absolutely.
And it produced the greatest anti-war speech that Britain has ever heard in the House of Commons. John Bright, who said, you know, the angel of death is abroad and come amongst us. One can all but hear the beating of his wings. And it all of that, and nobody ever learns. But anyway, moving on. There is some attempt, though, from the United States to sort of reach out. We've had apparently a productive call between Rubio and Lavrov. Trump and Putin seem to be able to speak. There's been also, with the other great power, China, there's been another conversation between Xi Jinping and Trump. However disorganized and chaotic this administration is, and it is, nonetheless, they do seem to be trying some level of diplomacy. Can we look at any hope there? I mean, is this going to achieve anything? Because we're not getting anything from Europe that's productive in any way. Britain, obviously, is a lost cause. What are your feelings about what's going on in the United States about this?
It is fascinating. Trump is trying to stop the war in Ukraine. He's got the right basic instinct, which is Putin's got a point. NATO should not be there. This was Obama's war. This is Biden's war. I don't want this. The United States doesn't need this, and so forth. All of that is in the right direction. It's fascinating how the American political class cannot get its head around this, by and large. And so the administration is getting attacked by, Mitch McConnell going after the defense secretary in Congress, that we must never allow Putin to win, and all of the neocon tropes, Lindsey Graham and so forth, the same way, Richard Blumenthal, absolutely awful people who've been wrong on every part of American foreign policy for three decades. So the battle in Washington continues. I would say after this extraordinary Ukraine attack on the strategic bombers, Trump put them in their place and said, stop, at least temporarily. And you heard voices like General Kellogg, who, you know, is kind of on the borderline between the two sides, say, don't do this. This was reckless. This was dangerous. I think this was a very sobering episode, a very embarrassing episode, because whether Trump knew or didn't know, it's embarrassing. It's, in fact, destabilizing and threatening. So for the moment, the recklessness of Ukraine has given Trump more political space. But the relentlessness of the American neocon political establishment, combined with Starmer, Mertz, Macron, Tusk, almost every day up until that bombing, meeting with Zelensky, and now, interestingly, keeping a distance from Zelensky for the moment. But all of that has meant that we are in between war and peace. My own view is the president of the United States has the power to end this war, but it requires political capital. He has to have an organized team that says, we stop. We do not provide armaments, and we do not provide intelligence to Ukraine, because we will not be a party to this ongoing war. and to explain that to the Europeans as well, which is, if you fight on, we can't stop you, but it would be ill-advised because you really can't do anything without us, and you know it. And to Mr. Zelensky, I would just explain the facts of life, which he did not have to hear from Biden for one single moment for 4 years. So to my mind, Trump has the power to make peace and to end this conflict. This is mainly between the U.S. and Russia. If Zelensky, as a martial law little clique, does not want to do that, I think the real negotiations anyway are between the United States and Russia, that the United States says NATO will not expand. We settle our other mutual security issues because we are the two largest superpowers in the world, and we were slipping towards nuclear war. We have a completely irresponsible regime in Ukraine that is provoking more, and we need to stop. And as I'm talking, I'm thinking to myself an analogy of this that's interesting, by the way. In the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, one of the things that ended the crisis was a call by Fidel Castro to Khrushchev to launch a nuclear war. And Khrushchev was so profoundly taken aback. He was shocked at the recklessness of his supposed ally that he immediately said, we got to bring this to a close. Cuba is out of control. And it was then actually that the message was sent to Kennedy, look, we can close this crisis down. We will take back the missiles. You will sooner rather than later remove your short-range missiles from Turkey. You will pledge never to invade Cuba again, and we'll be done with this crisis. But it was the recklessness, actually, of the Cuban government that provoked the two powers to say, this can't go on this way. In a way, Zelensky has done the same thing. The guy's nuts. The guy is he's not a one-man rule. He's a little clique, a little regime that does not represent the interests of the 20-year-olds that they're dragging off the streets and putting in vans and sending to their deaths in the front lines. And by the way, I got a long, really sad email from a stranger who said, I'm 48 years old and they are sending me to my death in Ukraine. Thank you for calling for peace. But it was a long email from a stranger in Ukraine. Yes, Zelensky does not represent the interests of the Ukrainian people, period. If he wanted to test that, have an election. But short of that, all he's doing is sending people to their deaths right now rather than negotiating. But my point is that the recklessness of this attack on strategic bombers is a kind of wake-up call, and it should be used by Russia and the United States to say, we've got to bring this to a close. And then the CIA is partly a government unto itself. It needs to be brought under control. It has not had any public airing of what it does for 50 years. It's literally exactly 50 years this year when the Church Committee, for the first and the only time in American history, had a public vetting of the CIA's role. I doubt MI6 has ever had such a thing, but I stand to be corrected on that. But the CIA was looked at one time and one time only, and that was 1975 by Idaho Senator Frank Church. And we desperately need it again today.
Well, to answer quickly your question, the MI6 has never had a public accounting until fairly recently. the British authorities pretended it didn't even exist officially.
There you go.
There you go. Professor Sachs, I'm going to finish there. Next time we have you, we do need to talk about the Middle East and Iran, and perhaps we will do that soon.
But, and by the way, I wanted to say, so that we're not out of date in a terrifying 5 minutes, whether the news is part of a game in the last hours or something real, whether Trump is trying to show the Iranians they better negotiate or I'm going to unleash the Israelis on them or not, we will not know. And we will never know until the events who gets the message and who doesn't and who abuses the message. But we are on the precipice. And everything we just said about Ukraine would be completely passé if Israel goes to bomb Iran, because then we really have stepped into a world war.
I agree. I completely agree. I know you're under time pressure, so we will stop here, but we will definitely come back, hopefully fairly soon, because we do need to discuss this thing. So if you have a moment, I'll just pass over to Alex.
Great.
And maybe Professor Sachs,
I know you've got maybe like a minute or two, but one quick question from Josie. Yeah. What advice would you give to ordinary people, those of us who are not politicians or involved in decision-making, especially here in Europe? How can we contribute to meaningful and positive change?
Yeah, wherever you are and in whichever ways you can, tell your politicians to stop the warmongering, to pick up the phone, and I offer them my Zoom account also, call your Russian counterpart and talk peace. This is what is needed. There isn't an inkling of it among any of the major European powers right now, but this is the most urgent point. The Europeans need to talk with their Russian counterparts.
Thank you, Professor Sachs.
And that was Jeffrey Sachs. Coming up, we have Shahid Bolson. This interview is going to be truncated because of our shortage of time.
I was listening to a space on X today, or yesterday rather. And, you know, there was this very obnoxious sort of white supremacist on there, kind of Charlie Kirk wannabe, you know, had the same demeanor, same typical sort of aggressive style, you know. They use aggression tactically to flood your limbic system, so your prefrontal cortex goes offline and your amygdala takes over. You should pay attention to that. Blood flow shifts from the reasoning centers of your brain to the motor cortex, you know, your working memory buffer, the space where you... in your brain, the space where you juggle facts, logic chains, rhetorical structure, and so on, that shrinks. So you forget your data. You stumble over your words and you get flustered. They interrupt you, they cut you off, they raise their voice, and so on. And it isn't just because they are rude and obnoxious and they have no manners. It's not just because of that. It's because they're wrong. And they know that in any calm, reasonable discussion, this will become blatantly obvious. So this is the approach they take, you know. They always claim to be people who love facts and who love logic. You know, facts don't care about your feelings and so on. But their whole style is tactically intended to sabotage the discussion of facts and logic. Because always, always, they cannot actually contend with facts and logic. You know, they pretend that they want that kind of a discussion. But they absolutely actually want to derail reasoning. And they want you to be emotional. You should take note of that. This is a patented Western approach. This is how they do. Always aggressive, always confrontational, always trying to, by hook or by crook, trying to undermine actual, reasoned, calm, intellectual discussion while always claiming that they're all about rationality. This is the West in microcosm. So anyway, this white supremacist was sort of rattling off all the standard talking points that he got from some, you know, KKK subreddit or what have you. The Jews were disproportionately responsible for American slavery, saying that the Jews owned the slave ships, the Jews financed the trade, the Jews owned most of the slaves, and so on. Imagine saying that. You must think we're really stupid. Like Alabama and Mississippi are renowned for their thriving Jewish populations, you know? Because, yeah, of course, Jews in America are... you know, have always been associated with agriculture. Sure. I mean, it's goofy. It's goofy on the face of it. But okay, let's address it. Let's actually address it. I mean, someone tweeted association with that space, a revisionist history figure that said that only 2% of American Southerners own slaves. You know, we've all actually misunderstood how truly upright and humane the American South really was. We've all misunderstood that. Well, look, the census of 1860, this isn't esoteric. Anyone can read the columns. You strip out the so-called free North and look at the families, look at the households, and you'll find that roughly one white Southerner in five kept human beings as property, with planter belts like Mississippi and South Carolina pushing closer to one out of every two. So no, we're not talking about 2%. We're talking about 20%, and in some places 50%. So don't try to act like slave ownership was some fringe practice in the South. It wasn't. And the only reason that the percentages of ownership aren't higher among the general population is because of affordability, not because of morality. The highest percentage of slave ownership by Jews in the American South was only around 1.3%. And that was just before the Civil War, and that was the highest that they ever got. And I'm sorry to tell you, but if you follow the money upstream in the slave industry in those days, you go upstream on that money chain, you're going to find churches and cathedrals, not synagogues. From the Portuguese to the English, with the what they call the Royal African Company, Liverpool, and so on. This is Christian Europe. Christian Europe's monarchs, Christian Europe's merchants, their insurers, and so on, they stamp their mark on every invoice. Liverpool alone dispatched somewhere around 5,000 slaving voyages between 1700 and 1807. That's a statistic that you can find in the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database online. You can look it up. Lloyd's of London was the insurer. They insured the traffic so thoroughly that slave voyages accounted for maybe around 5 to 10% of all marine premia in the late 18th century. And no, Lloyd's of London was not Jewish. They were Anglicans and they were Protestants. So just be honest. I mean, of course, Jews did participate. Of course they did. That was a lucrative evil that you normalized. But make no mistake about it. That was a white, European, Christian enterprise. Jews had a walk-on role. A historical ledger-by-ledger review of every surviving British and American slave voyage puts the Jews' share of the Atlantic traffic well under 2%. That's a statistical whisper beside the roar of Christian capital. Let's be serious. So no, the slave trade was not some covert Semitic conspiracy foisted on the innocent white Europeans. No, it was an enterprise conceived, financed, and defended by Christian imperial power. Jews just sampled a corner of the poison banquet that the Europeans had laid themselves. They spread that banquet out. Now, that's not to exonerate anyone who was involved in that. It's just facts. These are just the facts. You were the buyers. You were the transporters. You were the owners. You were the slave drivers, and everybody knows it. You want to put every wicked thing that you've done at the feet of the Jews. You know, were the Jews the masterminds behind the Spanish Inquisition? Were they the masterminds behind the Crusades, the Salem witch hunts? You know, the Jews, I suppose, made you genocide the Native Americans. The Jews made you lynch African Americans. The Jews made you drop the atomic bombs on Japan, right? I mean, come on. Every evil, every inhuman thing that you've done was done at the behest of the Jews, or it was done because the Jews manipulated you and controlled you. Is that what you want us to believe? If it wasn't for the Jews, you'd just love black people, wouldn't you? Meanwhile, this same white supremacist, this Charlie Kirk clone on that X space that I was listening to, was simultaneously spewing anti-black racist diatribes about, you know, low IQ, criminality, violent tendencies, on and on and on. The same old thing that you always hear from them. I mean, the man was embodying the exact mentality of the racist, dehumanizing white slave owners that he wants to pretend didn't exist, or he wants to pretend only existed because of the Jews. No, you were bad then and you're bad now. And you can't even open your mouth except that you announce it yourself by your own words. Even while you are trying to deflect and blame shift, You're racist, you're supremacist, you're cruel and heartless, and on top of all that, you're craven and cowardly because you do evil that you know is evil, but you want to try to pin it on someone else. You know, you don't even have the guts to just be wicked and own it yourself. And, you know, these are the same people who will say, well, you know, the Jews were kicked out of so many countries. There must be a reason. There has to be a reason for that. Never grasping that the hatred and supremacism that leaks out of your pores gives us the answer. You know, the venom and the viciousness of your loathing is on full display all the time. They hate Jews. They hate Muslims. They hate Africans. They hate Mexicans. They hate immigrants. It's endless. Who don't you hate? And always their malice is cast as if it's their victim's fault. Do you know how much you sound like a serial abuser talking about all his crazy exes? You're sick in the head. And I mean, look, what are their excuses? Jews made you do it, right? You know, Epstein blackmail, AIPAC, whatever the case may be. This is what they always say. Okay, let's go with Epstein, right? So it's his fault that you're a pedophile, right? I mean, if you're getting blackmail, you say that that Epstein is blackmailing all of these legislators and so forth, means you did something, didn't you? You did something unspeakable, and Jeffrey Epstein just facilitated it and put it on tape. That's just opportunistically taking advantage of your pre-existing perversion. What kind of argument is that? And AIPAC, right? They give legislators donations. Okay. So your argument is that you can be bribed. You know? You'll literally fund an armed genocide in exchange for what? A payoff? And that's your self-exoneration? That's your argument that you're actually good? The Jews made you do all these heinous crimes that you committed as a nation? Really? Then honestly, how pathetic are you as a nation? How stupid are you as a nation? How incompetent are you as a nation? How immoral are you as a nation? That's your argument? I mean, for a white Western supremacist, you sure seem to believe that white Westerners are the absolute dregs of mankind. You believe that apparently these white, supreme white people have no agency, no willpower, no morality, no ethics, no conviction, no intelligence. I mean, that's your own argument. That's not me. That's you saying it. Meanwhile, you believe in the Ubermensch, Superman, Aryan super race, the master race. But according to you, this so-called master race has been played with like a yo-yo to do the bidding of Jews throughout all of your recorded history. I mean, are you starting to see why they absolutely do not want to have a reasoned discussion about their ideas? Because it's not only their ideas are not only void of facts, they have filled that void with utter self-contradictory nonsense. But look, it's good. The blame shifting is good, honestly, because it shows how badly they want to distance themselves, how badly they want to disassociate themselves from what they are having the Israelis do for them in Gaza, what they are having the Israelis do for them in the region. You know, we're on the verge of the great divorce. And I've been telling you that we would see, I've been telling you for a long time now, that we're going to see the floodgates open in terms of that latent, seething, and ever-present Western anti-Jewish hatred. That's why you sent the Jews over there to do it in the first place. That's why. That's why you made your colonial stormtroopers a Jewish brigade, precisely so that you could disavow them when the time came. I saw this coming years ago, and here we are. It's the Jews. I mean, it's our money, it's our weapons, it's our policy, it's our political coverage, it's our bombs, it's our missiles, it's our attack helicopters, it's our support, but it's the Jews. Because it's the henchman who always takes the fall. That's why they set the system up like that, plausible deniability. And that's why they're going hard in the paint with the blame shifting now. That's why you've got your Candace Owens types, your Tucker Carlson types, and so on, sort of opening the tap on despising Jews in acceptable public discourse. It's transparent. And no, I've said it many times, the Israelis are absolutely responsible for their actions. No question about it. Just like the death squads that Washington unleashed on Central and South America. Just like every hired killer, just like every mercenary is responsible for his crimes. No question about it. The henchmen are responsible for what they do. The hitmen are responsible for what they do. The Nazi guards who were just following orders were responsible for their actions. But that doesn't get their superiors off the hook. That doesn't mean that they're the only ones who are responsible. No. But you see this blame shifting, this emerging narrative, that's by no means a new narrative, by the way, about, you know, Jewish iniquity, Jewish wickedness, Jewish control, that old Nazi narrative. This is emerging anew right now for the purpose of blame shifting. I've talked about it before. But think through what that means. It's deliberate alibi creation by the West. It's cleanup. It's trying to wipe their fingerprints off the crime scene. Well, what does that mean? Well, in court, that would be proof of premeditation and full cognition that what you did was wrong. That you knew what you did was wrong. It means you're in full command of your faculties. There's no insanity defense for you. So you see, it means that you know that these are horrible crimes that you committed. Slavery, lynching, genocide, Zionism. It shows that you know perfectly well that these are irredeemable crimes that you committed. You know right and wrong. That's why you want to distance yourselves. You want to blame shift. You want to disavow. Because you know that what you did is monstrous. But just look at the corruption. You know, look at the complete absence of character on the part of the West, on the part of the Americans. Because what a decent person would do is repent. A decent person would own up to what they did and repent. They would be contrite. They would be remorseful. They would stop what they were doing and they would try to atone. That's what a decent person would do. And that's what a decent nation would do. But that's not what you do. You try to pin it on someone else. You want to pin it on your partner in crime. You want to get out of it by any means. You have no concept of accountability. The West has no concept of accountability. Just look at the corruption. Look at this weaselly character, Uncle Sam. Oh, he's a weasel. Uncle Sam is the most craven, cowardly, unmanly, weaseliest character in the history of nations, honestly. Whenever the bill comes due for the things that he's done, he tries to slide it under the door. He tries to, you know, slip it under someone else's door and tiptoe away. No. The slave ships in the transatlantic slave trade were captained by men with names like Roberts and Smith, not Bernstein and Rothbard. I mean, how many African Americans you know today who today, still until now, carry the family names of their enslaved ancestors' owners? How many of them are named Cohen and Leibowitz rather than Jones or Washington? No. And the Zionist genocide of the Palestinians that's been going on for all these decades, that has been underwritten and it has been overseen by men named Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush again, Obama, Trump, Biden, and Trump again. And every single one of those men have underwritten and have overseen catastrophic violence, war crimes, crimes against humanity, massacres, death squads, drone strikes, invasions, assassinations, coups, overthrows, forced starvation on whole populations, mass murder, torture, and inhuman brutality all around the world. And every single one of those criminals has a statue erected for him in his honor in your country. That's your people. Yes, you know right and wrong. Otherwise, you wouldn't try to disassociate yourselves from your evil actions. But that's the only instinct you have when it comes to right and wrong. Self-exoneration, self-preservation. You don't use the knowledge of right and wrong to choose doing right. You only use that knowledge to avoid the consequences of doing wrong. That's what you do with your recognition of what's right and what's wrong. You have no moral hygiene. As long as your reputation can stay clean, you don't care how dirty your actions are. That's the West. See, this is crucial to understand. This shows that you have a commitment, an absolute commitment to wrongdoing. Do you understand me? It shows that you have a dedication to never changing, never repenting, never taking accountability, never looking your victims in the face and begging for forgiveness. Do you understand? The whole world looks at America and sees you sitting in the dock of the court, but you keep trying to act like you're sitting behind the judge's bench. You're delusional. Your whole history is a rap sheet. Your whole history is a criminal record. Everyone's memory of you around the world is one giant chorus of indictments and accusations and recriminations, not allegations. No, You've been convicted in the hearts and minds of the people of every country that you ever touched. Meanwhile, you're trying to tell us, you're trying to tell all of the people that you victimized that we're supposed to despise someone else, we're supposed to blame someone else, hate someone else. At this point, you're only gaslighting yourselves. No one believes you. No one's listening to you. On that space, this white supremacist was arguing that white supremacy isn't a thing. And he said, give me an example of white supremacy today in 2025. The question is an example. Your denial is an example of white supremacy. The fact that you think that literally centuries of experience, experience right up until this very moment while I'm speaking right now, the fact that you think that the lived misery of millions of people for hundreds of years from your racism, your bigotry, your hatred, your violence, your exploitation, your pillage and your plunder, you think that all of that is negated by the power of your denial, the entitlement. You think that we're going to watch you. You think that we're going to listen to you, literally spewing venom against everyone else, against Jews, against Muslims, against so-called black people, against immigrants, against Asians, against Indians, against basically anyone except white Anglo-Saxons. And somehow we're supposed to understand from all of that that we got you wrong, and you're really a fair-minded, unbiased believer in human equality. Come on. And if we listen to all of your hatred and understand from that, that you are, in fact, a racist, white supremacist, bigoted, mouth-breathing, knuckle-dragging, hate-filled heathen, if that's what we take, then you'll just say, well, it's because we have low IQs. An example of white supremacy? You're the embodiment of white supremacy. It's the racial equivalent of malignant narcissism, you know? It's that fake superiority of the wholly inadequate, morally inadequate, intellectually inadequate, culturally inadequate, spiritually inadequate, developmentally inadequate, and trying to act superior. The only thing that you excel at is pretending otherwise. And if you interpret what I'm saying, by the way, let me clarify this. If you interpret what I'm saying as so-called reverse racism, no. I'm not even talking about it racially. You are. I don't attach your crimes to your skin color. You do. What I indict are your deeds. But you take that as an attack on so-called white people because you've got that on the brain. I don't. So-called white and so-called black is only a thing because you made it a thing. And you insist on keeping it a thing. That puts you in a position of having to make European and American crimes like it's an inherent aspect of so-called whiteness. So that means that you can't repent from your crimes because you think that that would mean basically admitting that criminality is encoded in your DNA. That's what your sick theories and your ideas and your sick culture did to you. You racialize everything. So you can't even be honest about your history because you think that if you're honest about your history, then that would be a racial indictment. So for the sake of defending your so-called whiteness, okay, you either defend or you deny or you dismiss or you shift the blame for all of your horrific and shameful history. You don't have to do that. In fact, you have to not do that. Racialization is a sickness that you inflicted upon yourself. And then you inflicted it upon the rest of the world. So now you feel the need to try to side with or be loyal to or align yourself with literally unspeakable crimes. Just because the people who committed those crimes were wearing the same color skin as you. You created this atrocious notion that so-called race is actually a meaningful classification of human beings and that it's hierarchical and that it denotes all of the sorts of qualities and traits that are actually only present in a human being by their conscious choices, not by genetic coding.
And that was Shahid Bolson. You can look him up on YouTube, Shahid Bolson.